Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Human Anatomy Bio 231 for the summertime. The date is the 17th of June. So this is our third lecture. Let's take a look at the schedule. We were talking about cells. That's chapter 2 last time. We're going to finish that up and get into chapter 4, which is tissues. We've got two lectures on tissues, and we're not going to cover 3. And then that means that next week we're going to cover integument and then a chapter on bones. That's chapter 5 and 6. And then on Thursday, we have exam number 1 on chapters 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6. And remember, we're not covering chapter 3. So did I get that right? The 24th is a Wednesday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And what's today? Today's a Wednesday. So it's 1 week away from today. All right, and let's go over some of the stuff you need for a lecture exam. Here is your Scantron that you need, and this is an 882E, and you can probably use an 882ES, but don't get an 882 Lovas. That one usually does not work because the little letters are already kind of shaded, they're kind of bubbled in already, and the Scantron reader does get confused with that sometimes. Okay. Your Scantron should be nice and clean, shouldn't be all bent up and have marks on it, because then it will get stuck in the Scantron reader, or the reader will mark it wrong, and you won't get credit for your answers, right? And especially if it gets stuck in the Scantron reader, then I can't grade anybody else's test either, right? So make sure you have a nice, clean Scantron to fill in. That's what you need, and a pencil, of course. And what's even more important than a pencil? An eraser, a really good eraser. So I put some erasers that work on this particular type of paper, pretty much with any pencil, try to get one of those. But in any case, get a piece of paper and your pencil, make a mark on it, and erase it with that eraser that you plan to use. If it smudges up that paper, doesn't erase it clean, then throw that eraser away, right? Because it's just going to cause a lot of problems for you. Same thing, whenever you take a board exam, make sure that you have a good pencil to write and a good eraser. A board exam, you'll never get back, and if you fail a board exam, you'll never know why, and it might be that there are just stray marks on there, or maybe you made some eraser marks that didn't get erased properly, right? So practice really good filling out a Scantron technique now so that you don't get wasted points on a board exam or something. Because you don't want to have to take a board exam over again because they're expensive. Does anybody know how expensive a board exam is? I think it's about $250. All right, so if you got to cough up another couple $100 just because there's a stray mark on your Scantron, that's terrible. Right, so just get it down so it is no problem for you. Here is the sign-in sheet for today. This is the current list that I got off of WebStar. So if your name is not on there, then we probably have to talk. All right, and find out what happened and see if I made a mistake or registration made a mistake or something like that. Okay, so that was Wednesday, the 24th, and on the 25th is your first practicum. Got a little lecture on skeletal system in the morning early and then a practicum later on in the morning. And I think that's labs 1, 2, and 3. But when we get to lab, I'll check to make sure that that is true. Actually, we can slide down here really fast. And see, so lab number 1, lab number 2, lab number 3, nice. And then, yeah, and then we get a little review day. Oh, that's excellent, okay. And then your first practicum. So today, you have a lab quiz. You know what's on that, anything that's in lab number 1. And then a week from today, lab quiz number 2. And that's probably going to cover stuff that we have in lab number 2 and maybe even lab number 3. All right, so that's pretty much the schedule. So, what's probably the most important thing? Well, most important thing, you're coming to class, so you didn't get dropped, so that's really good. But the other most important thing is to make sure you can log into Blackboard. So if you're having problems logging into Blackboard, you got to see me. As a matter of fact, raise your hand right now. Anybody having problems getting into, we got to fix that today, okay? And I think we'll be able to do that pretty easy, all right? So during lab sometime, or after lecture maybe, we'll take care of it, okay? It shouldn't take too long to do that. Okay. Any questions over what we talked about last time? For all of these organelles, you should have a little bullet point in your mind what the function is of that particular organelle and what it looks like. on that exam figure that has the whole cell all drawn out on it. So you should know the function of mitochondria, for instance. Function of mitochondria, what's that? Make ATP. Yeah, and just for your own information, those mitochondria need oxygen, and they also could use sugar to make ATP. All right, so oxygen is very important. And I want to give you a sense of how important ATP is in your body, right? It's the energy molecule that keeps you alive. And how many, and your brain uses ATP pretty rapidly. So if you cut off blood supply to the brain, like your heart stops, then your brain is going to stop functioning. How much time do you have of consciousness after blood stops going to the brain do you have? After blood stops going to the brain, when do you become unconscious? Okay, 5 minutes. That's a pretty good guess. That's a pretty short period of time. Yeah, I like that. But here is the real answer. The real answer is between 1 to 2 seconds. No, I think it's 2 to 3 seconds. 2 to 3 seconds and you pass out. So you can't maintain consciousness because your ATP is being used up. And if ATP is production is not restored, then eventually that brain is going to die. When does a person's brain die? When their heart stops, blood isn't going to the brain, right? So we said you pass out 2 to 3 seconds. When does the brain actually die? And when a brain dies, what does that mean? Cannot come back to life, right? If you lose consciousness, the brain still can come back to life. You can still regain consciousness. But after a certain period of time, the brain can't ever come back because it's dead. What is that period of time? Yeah, it's about 2 to 3 minutes. So that's probably maybe what you were thinking about. Okay, brain death, 2 to 3 minutes. You lose consciousness, 2 to 3 seconds. So that just kind of underscores how fast ATP is used up in the brain, and that's similar to many other kinds of tissues in your body. And that also says how important it is for people to know something about CPR, because if somebody knows something about CPR, you can help beat somebody's heart and help them breathe even though they're not breathing by themselves and their heart isn't beating for them. All right, so that is really cool. Doing chest compressions and then mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Now here is something funny about that. So remember, you lose consciousness, but your brain is not dead yet. But you're unconscious and you might actually look kind of dead. When you start doing CPR on somebody, they're not going to jump up, they're not going to maintain consciousness, they're not going to come back to being conscious and thank you. But guess what? You might get enough oxygen, enough blood to the brain to keep it from dying until somebody can really help them and get their heart started again. So that's why they say, once you start CPR, what should you do? How long should you do it for? Okay, yeah, you just keep doing it until some paramedics arrive or something like that that can take over. So you're not ever supposed to stop because you can't really tell if that person is really dead or not. They just might be unconscious, right? So keep doing that, and maybe somebody in here who's not CPR certified, maybe develop a little interest to become CPR certified to help save somebody's life. This is kind of a small class in the summertime, but usually I have one student in a class. Sometimes I have 100 students in the class during the regular semester, and I'll ask, has anybody ever done CPR on somebody? And somebody will raise their hand. And so I'm going to ask you guys, anybody in here do CPR on somebody? Because their heart stopped beating, or maybe they started choking. Yeah, cool. So that's really good. It's amazing. All right, we'll probably talk some more about that when we get into the respiratory chapter as well. So that's the importance of ATP. And here's another way of thinking about it. How much ATP would you have to have in your hand to maintain your life for a whole day? Because you need ATP, it gets broken down into ADP and inorganic phosphate, and then it gets built up again. But you use up ATP to stay alive. How much ATP do you need for a whole day? That's kind of an interesting question. Well, let's compare it to what your body weight is. A typical person's body weight, a textbook body weight, is 70 kilograms. 70 kilograms. Somebody pull your calculator out and tell me what that is in pounds. I'm not sure what that is. Probably a little bit over 100 pounds, something like that. Well, if your body weight is 70 kilograms, you need 40 kilograms of ATP to stay alive every day. That's more than half your body weight. So again, that just really tells you how important those mitochondria are and how important ATP is. Fortunately, you don't have to walk around with a suitcase or luggage filled with ATP because your body can regenerate. As soon as it breaks down, it's regenerated as long as you have what organelle? Mitochondria. Yeah, mitochondria. And of course, those mitochondria, like I said, need oxygen to function. All right, so that ATP is critical. It's probably almost everybody's favorite molecule. Okay. So that's something about organelles. What organelle is there for modification and packaging? Yeah, that Golgi apparatus, or you could say Golgi body, either way. What little tiny organelle can make a protein? Ribosome, that's right. So you have two different kinds of endoplasmic reticulum, one that has ribosomes on it. So what's the function of that rough endoplasmic reticulum? Protein synthesis, because it has ribosomes. The other kind of endoplasmic reticulum doesn't have ribosomes, so it can't make a protein, but it's responsible for synthesis. What does it synthesize? Lipids, like phospholipids. And phospholipids are an important building block for a structure that we looked at last time. What is a phospholipid a basic building block of? The cell membrane, that's right. Every cell membrane, right? You think of the phospholipid bilayer is a good way to start thinking about a membrane, but then you got to realize that cells can put other things inside that phospholipid bilayer, proteins and sugar molecules and other kinds of lipids. So the best way to think about a cell membrane is with the fluid mosaic model. The fluid part is just a basic phospholipid bilayer. That's the fluid part. The mosaic part of that concept is all of those other things that are put in the membrane, like proteins and sugar molecules and other kinds of lipids, right? So it's a complex structure, and you should consider it an organelle. Okay, let's look at the nucleus a little bit more. We talked about the nucleolus. That's the active part of the nucleus, and we saw some nuclear pores last time. Let's take a look. All right, so here is the nucleus. Here is the nuclear envelope. We don't want to say membrane because there are actually two membranes. There's an inner and an outer membrane. So there are actually two phospholipid bilayers right here, one on top of the other. Right? So we call it an envelope. And for large molecules to get through this envelope, there has to be a pathway. And here is a pathway that's just called a nuclear pore for large molecules to move back and forth. And then here's that nucleolus, the active part. And then in this part of the nucleus, right, this is where genetic material is contained. And genetic material is all wrapped up in a structure that we call a chromosome. And humans, remember from last time, we have 46 chromosomes, 23 from mom, 23 from dad. All right, so the 23 you get from your mom, we call those maternal chromosomes. And the other, they're labeled P, you get those from papa. Right? Okay. All right, so that is the nucleus. When I look at this nucleus, think about what we were doing last time. Is this cell undergoing mitosis? And how could you tell or how can't you tell? Is it undergoing mitosis? Okay. When I look inside the nucleus, that's the hint. I heard something about somes, but I didn't catch the first part of that word. What don't you see in this nucleus right here? I don't see those structures that we call chromosomes that you can see with a light microscope. The genetic material is all strung out. It's not wrapped up to make a chromosome. And when it's all strung out like that, then it is busy, right, starting the process of making a protein. So this cell right here is in interphase. It's not undergoing mitosis because I don't see any chromosomes. So let's take a look at that genetic material in a little bit more detail. All right. Genetic material is a compound that we call a nucleic acid. So here is a DNA molecule, and the building block of a DNA molecule is a nucleotide, right? And nucleotides are just put together one after the other. All right, so this is a really, really long strand, and it's super thin, so it's pretty fragile. It can break, and if it breaks, then probably that cell is going to die. So what our cells do to protect this chromosome is that it's wrapped up, or this chromatin right here, it's wrapped up on proteins. And these proteins are what we call histones. Right, so here is that really long nucleic acid that we looked at. Here are some proteins that we call histones. When this DNA is not being used to make a protein, it's wrapped around these histone molecules. Now you can see kind of wrapped up, so this looks like a little spool with some thread on it. And then these things right here, made up of histones and DNA, we call this a nucleosome, and then the nucleosomes are wrapped around some more, and there's some more twists and turns. And so this big long strand of DNA is folded up and wrapped up so it becomes very short but thick. And this short, thick chromosome is something that you can see underneath the light microscope, which is what we did the very last part of lab. And maybe we can start that up next time. All right, so here's a chromosome. There are actually two. It's been replicated already. There's one right here, and then there's one down over here. So this one is ready to undergo mitosis. One daughter cell will get this top piece, the other daughter cell will get this bottom piece, and that chromosome will be preserved from generation to the next. Chromatin, in order to be used, or DNA, in order to be used, it has to be unwound from all of these histone molecules, okay, in order to start protein synthesis. And when it's unwound from these histone molecules, it's very vulnerable. It can be damaged, right? And that's why these thin filaments are placed, let's go all the way back, are placed inside the nuclear envelope. That's what protects that DNA from destruction under most circumstances during interphase. Right? And then when it's time to undergo mitosis, the nuclear envelope has to disappear. Right? And so how is this DNA now protected? How does it become protected? Because that nuclear envelope is not there to protect it anymore. It is wrapped up, right? Wrapped up on all these histone proteins, and then it becomes protected, right? So things can't get at that DNA strand. So when it's unwound, like what we see during interphase, we call that extended chromatin. It's really long and small filament. And when the cell is undergoing mitosis, that chromatin then is all wrapped up on these histones. We call this condensed chromatin. So the usable kind is extended chromatin. The one that's in a safe condition but cannot be used is what we call condensed chromatin. So two kinds of chromatin. When it's in a condensed form, then the nuclear envelope doesn't have to be there, and the cell can undergo mitosis when that takes place. So how do I think about these two different forms of chromatin, extended versus condensed? All right, which one is in a protected form? Condensed, right? So condensed is in a protected form, but it can't be used by the cell, right? The one that is in a very vulnerable form is chromatin, right? But if it's in that extended form, it can be used to make a protein. That's the most physiologic, the most functional kind of DNA, because it can actually be used by the cell. So when I think of extended or vulnerable and condensed, safe or protected DNA, I think of like going on a vacation someplace. And when you go on a vacation, what kind of stuff do you take with you? What would you do? Say you got an hour right now. I'm going to hand you an airplane ticket to Hawaii or Denpasar or someplace like that. What are you going to take with you? Maybe another shirt, maybe some other shoes, maybe your swimming trunks, okay? I don't know, maybe your tennis racket, sunglasses, toothbrush, hairbrush, all that kind of stuff, right? Another pair of pants. So do you walk on the airplane with your sunglasses and hairbrush and toothpaste and extra pair of pants, another pair of shoes, tennis racket? Do you walk onto the airplane with all of that stuff right there in your hands? Maybe you haven't gone on an airplane. I don't know. Who's not been on an airplane? Some people. Okay, y'all been on an airplane. So what do you do with all this stuff? You package it. Yeah, you put it in a suitcase or a luggage, right? When you package it in that luggage, for instance, let's think of just your sunglasses. If your sunglasses are in the luggage, it means you can't lose them, right? Because they're in that piece of luggage. They're not going to leave them in a restaurant or something. But if they're in that piece of luggage, can you use those sunglasses? No, right? So that's why I think condensed chromatin that I see right here is like all of those precious belongings in a suitcase that you can't use, but it's protected. And then when you take it out of the suitcase, right, those sunglasses, it's in a vulnerable form because you can, if you take them off and you go into a building and leave them and forget about it, then you'll lose it, right? So I think of all those good things in, okay, your suitcase when you take them out as extended chromatin. I see something happening. I'm not sure what it is, but I noticed something else. I'm going to turn this light off. Okay. Okay, extended versus condensed. You should be aware of, so you see that there's a change in structure, right? Here's chromatin that is extended. Here's chromatin that is condensed. So if there's a change in structure, what should you imagine right away? Change in function. That's right. Usable, not usable. Protected, not protected. That is what we call a trade-off, right? Okay. Well, membranes are pretty specific. Not everything, not every molecule can move across a membrane. Hopefully it will mostly stay on and not turn off. Oh, God, it's freaky. Oh, it's freaking out completely. I have no idea. I don't think it's the computer. I think it's the projector. Okay, cross your fingers. Okay, a membrane, things, not everything can move across that cell membrane. Only certain things and certain things at certain times. All right, so here is a cell membrane. Remember, we said all of this stuff, cytoplasm, on the inside of the cell is the living material, and then you have a bunch of molecules on the outside of the cell, which is the non-living material. And it's the job of this cell membrane, or one of the jobs of the cell membrane, is to make sure that all the molecules that are needed to support life can get in the cell. And things that are going to be detrimental to life, the cell kicks out, has to move across that cell membrane. So we want to know something about how material moves across the cell membrane, and that's what we have right here. There are two main processes. When we think about transport or movement across the cell membrane, there can be a passive transport mechanism or there can be an active transport mechanism. So what makes active different from passive transport? Okay, one requires energy. That's what we mean by active transport. Active transport requires energy. And what's your favorite energy molecule once again? ATP. That's right. So active transport requires ATP in order to move something across the membrane. ATP is broken down into ADP and another phosphate molecule, and then also energy is released. So you could think of energy as like being a participant in this particular reaction, almost like a chemical. It's a physical substance. Okay? It's hard to talk about, though. ATP, this T stands for tri or three. ATP has three phosphates on it. Right, one of these comes off, so if you have 3 minus 1, what are you left with? 2, and that's what that D stands for, adenosine diphosphate, right, or adenosine 2-phosphates. And then what's the job of the mitochondria? To take ADP and this inorganic phosphate, join them together to make an ATP. But a mitochondria, when it takes an ADP and an inorganic phosphate and joins them together, what else does the mitochondria need?
Energy.
It needs energy, right? And it can get at that energy if it has a sugar molecule and oxygen, and then it can generate ATP. How much ATP every day do these mitochondria generate? A lot or little? A lot, right? More than half your body weight. Okay, so active, so transport, these active transport processes require a lot of energy, right, in form of ATP. So you should realize then that the brain is very active and it has a lot of active transport moving material across the cell. Passive transport, right, does not require energy, and the process is called diffusion. And diffusion is a process that just happens automatically. So for instance, if I snuck in a bottle of perfume, and while I'm lecturing with the lights off, I open up the bottle of perfume, and there's no fan blowing air around here in the room, what would happen? What would happen to that perfume? Would you ever notice that I opened up a perfume bottle even though you didn't see me? You didn't see me bring it in? You didn't see me open it up? Would you ever smell perfume? And the answer is yes. The perfume, right, would evaporate into the air. It would become high concentration in the front of the room. And the concentration in the back, what would be the concentration in the back as soon as I open up the bottle of perfume? Yeah, it'd be zero or low, right? And so that perfume would move by diffusion from an area of high concentration in the front of the room to the back of the room. People in the first row would smell it first, then the second row, and then the third row, and finally even people in the back row would smell that perfume. And even without moving, without any kind of fan or air motion or anything. All right, so in order for diffusion to take place, there has to be a concentration difference. Right? So if I open up that perfume bottle tomorrow and close all the doors and we come back on Monday, guess what the concentration would be in the front of the room compared to the back of the room? They would be equal. And when the concentration is equal, diffusion stops. Right? But no matter where you would be on Monday morning, you would smell the same concentration of perfume, and then diffusion would stop because it requires a concentration difference. And the way that a molecule moves by diffusion is from high concentration to low concentration. That's the only way it can go. Right? Active transport, on the other hand, material can go from low concentration to high concentration, but it also requires energy. So those are some of the big differences. So when I think of diffusion, maybe I'm going to draw this on the board. I think of a car that I had when I was in college. I really loved this car. And I don't know why. Right? It was really old. It was really small. It was an MGB. Anybody ever hear of an MGB? Okay. They're about this long, okay, and about this wide. Two people could sit in it. And it had a nice manual shift. It was really fun to drive. But since it was so old, it would break all the time. Battery would be dead. Brakes would fail. And starter motor on the car would fail. So when you turn the key, it wouldn't start the engine. Okay. So what would I do? So here's that nice little MGB. So when I would park the car and go to school, guess where I would park my car? Because I wasn't sure I could start it and go home. Maybe the battery would be dead or starter motor or something would be wrong with it. Guess what I would do? I would park on top of a hill. I'd park on top of a hill. Because it had a manual transmission, even with the battery dead starter motor, all I have to do is like put one leg out the door, give it a little push, and it would it start to roll down this hill all by itself? It would. I'd pop the clutch, that would start the motor, and then I could drive home, which is really, really nice. Okay, so this car moving down this hill over here, did that require the engine to be on? Not requiring any energy, right? So this is passive, right? That's the passive motion of this car moving down the hill. Does not require energy. No energy required, right? But how does something have to go? It has to go from high to low concentration, right? So that's just kind of a little model you should think of in your mind to see that. All right, well, what about this car that's down over here on the bottom of the hill? Can it get to the top over here? Doesn't seem like it can. Can it get to the top? You know what? How did my car get to the top to begin with? So there must be a way to get there, right? Well, if the engine is working, right, I can drive up the hill, right? I can drive up. But going from low concentration to high, what's required? In this case, gasoline, but just think of gasoline as what? Energy. Is energy. All right, and that's what we call active transport. So think in terms of molecules. Molecule going from high concentration to low is passive. What do we call that passive motion? Passive is diffusion. Okay, that's diffusion. And then going from low to high concentration requires energy. That is active transport. All right, so just kind of use that little model in your mind when you think of some of these questions on a test. Here is a special kind of diffusion, osmosis. Osmosis is passive. All right, so how do molecules move by osmosis if it's passive? From high to low or low to high? If it's passive, it's got to be from high to low, right? High to low if it's passive. All right, so what the heck is osmosis? Well, since it's passive, something moving from high to low, the first thing osmosis is diffusion. Because it's passive. Diffusion. Okay? So there are some criteria for when a molecule moves across the membrane if it is osmosis. The second criteria is that it is only for the water molecule, H2O. All right, so it's got to be water. Can't be something else. Can't be like a sugar or lipids. Got to be water. And is water important in your body? Yeah, that's what all these chemicals are dissolved in, right? We're just a soup, a mixture of various chemicals, and they're all dissolved in water. So water is important. And there's one more criteria in order for osmosis to be taking place, right? First is passive diffusion. The second has to be the water molecule. The third thing is that water has to go through a membrane, and it's got to go through a particular kind of membrane we call semi-permeable. Okay, semi-permeable membrane. So membrane is key, and semi-permeable is key as well. All right, so on this slide right here of the cell, do you see a membrane? Where's my cursor? Here it is. Do you see a membrane? I see a membrane right here. Okay. And if water is at a high concentration outside and low concentration inside, which way will water want to go? If it's high outside and low inside, just passively, which way would water want to move? Yeah, we'll want to move inside the cell, going down the concentration gradient. Okay, so water molecule is going to move by diffusion, right, from high concentration to low. And then the other thing is, here's that membrane, right, here's membrane, and indeed that membrane is selectively permeable or semi-permeable. It doesn't let everything across. In this particular case, it will let a water molecule, right, but not everything else, so that is semi-permeable. So because it's diffusion, because it's water, because the membrane is selectively permeable, then that would be something that we would call osmosis. Okay. If it's active transport of water, can't be osmosis. Then that would be some other kind of active transport mechanism. Okay, I had a thought, but I forgot what it was. It will come back to me. But that's pretty much a complete thought for osmosis anyway. Okay, active transport. What molecule is necessary for active transport in most cases? It's going to be ATP, right, that you get from those mitochondria. There are a couple other kinds of active transport mechanisms. But in physiology, you'll learn about some of those. Okay, so what kind of process, what kind of active transport processes are there? Like molecular transport? Transport of molecules, which are really small things that you can't see them, like sugars and little lipid particles. Or they could be big, large macromolecules, or even pieces of a cell or something like that, or pieces of a membrane. Right? So that's particle or macromolecular transport. So let's look at the slide over here. Here I see some material that is inside this vesicle. The vesicle moves over to the plasma membrane and opens up to the outside world. And then all of the stuff that was inside the vesicle is released to the extracellular space or outside of the cell. It takes energy to move this vesicle around. Okay? It takes energy to incorporate it into the plasma membrane. Right? So if it takes energy to move these particles outside of the cell, what kind of process is that? That's an active transport mechanism, right? And it can be small molecules or it could be large molecules, it really doesn't matter, or even pieces of a cell, okay? Okay, So when a cell is releasing material, we call that secretion, right? But another way that we could talk about it is exocytosis. Exocytosis is when material is secreted from the cell or somehow kicked out of the inside of the cell. That's exocytosis. This process can go in the reverse, right? These particles outside of the cell can enter into a little dimple in the cell membrane, and then that little dimple gets deeper and deeper and deeper, and then finally pinches off. So all the stuff is inside the cell. That is what we call endocytosis. Endocytosis. I should probably modify this cell. Endocytosis. Endocytosis. Okay. So exocytosis is nice. Good enough. Endocytosis is bringing material in. Exocytosis is moving material out at the expense of ATP. And there's two kinds of endocytosis. So these two things, let's see if I can do this. Control X. I can't do it. Control X. All right. They should belong. Okay. They should be. Oh, I'm doing something funny. Exocytosis. What I'm trying to do here is put them. Sorry, can't do it for some reason. Okay. Phagocytosis and pinocytosis are some subcategories of endocytosis. Right? So phagocytosis and pinocytosis is endocytosis. So which way are particles moving for phagocytosis and pinocytosis? They're moving inside the cell, right? Because it's endocytosis. Pinocytosis means cell drinking. So the cell can actually bring into the cell a solution of compounds, right, that are dissolved in water. Some particles are so big, or cell fragments are so big, they can't dissolve in water. And then if they're brought into the cell, we call that phagocytosis. Phago just means eating. Phagocytosis is cell eating. Pinocytosis is cell drinking, both forms of endocytosis, and they're both active transport mechanisms. Okay, one last topic I want to talk about in this particular chapter, protein synthesis. So proteins are a pretty important molecule in our body, and who knows what the building block of a protein is? Probably everybody kind of knows just from hanging around and watching TV and talking to people. All right, how is a protein made? What does it need? What's the basic building block? What is it made of? Proteins are made from amino acids. Okay, has anybody ever heard of an amino acid? I would guess probably a lot of people have heard of amino acids. Probably haven't dealt with them extensively like in a anatomy or physiology class or biochemistry class, but you will. Right? And so in order to make a protein, you need amino acids. These are small little pieces. Okay? And amino acids are put together to make a big long chain, and that big long chain of amino acids is what we call a protein. Okay, so how does a cell make a protein? Well, here is something that is called the central dogma in biology for protein synthesis, right? And a dogma is something that you should never question, that you just believe in, and that you think is going to be true no matter what, right? And that's a pretty good place to start. But in science, what do you know about science? Does dogma and science, do they ever go together? No. Scientist is always going to question knowledge, right, and find out if it's true or false or under what conditions it's true, right? Scientists always questions authority because there really is no ultimate authority, because scientists want to learn things, right? And they ask questions. But nonetheless, we're going to start with this dogma and then build upon it a little bit later. So the central dogma in biology, at least for this part of the slide, you should never question. Okay, so here is something. We have DNA, that's genetic material. Where do you find DNA? In the nucleus right here. Okay, and then it's converted into RNA. It sounds kind of familiar, the same as DNA, right? DNA, RNA sound kind of similar, both NA at the end of the word. Well, these compounds are very similar, and then RNA is converted into a protein. So it starts, protein synthesis starts in what organelle inside the cell? In the nucleus, because that's where DNA is, okay? And then that RNA leaves the nucleus, and that RNA along with a ribosome can make a protein. Right, so that RNA with a ribosome can make a protein. And as a matter of fact, the ribosome is actually made out of RNA as well. Okay, and then a protein is made. So where are proteins made? In the nucleus or in the cytosol? In the cytosol. So how many step process do you see when DNA is converted into RNA and RNA is converted into a protein? How many steps do you see? I see two. I see two arrows, right? So that's a nice graphic. There's two arrows. And what can you tell me about those arrows? Are they bidirectional? Is one bidirectional and one only unidirectional? Or are these arrows all pointing in one direction and you can't go backwards? One direction and can't go backwards, right? So that's the part of the central dogma in biology. It says that information in DNA, the structure of DNA, can be used and can be converted into information in RNA, and then the information in RNA can be used to make a protein. Right? So DNA makes RNA, which makes a protein. Protein synthesis is directed by information in DNA. And that is really important. Right? A protein in your body can't be used to make RNA, and then RNA used to make DNA. So proteins cannot change your DNA inside the cell. And that's really good. At least I think so. Because if you go home tonight and have a chicken dinner, right, you don't have to worry about waking up in the morning with a beak and feathers. That's a really good thing, right? So information does not go backwards, only in this direction. So what's important for you to know? DNA to RNA happens inside the nucleus because that's where DNA is. Then RNA leaves. RNA conversion into protein happens in the cytosol, right? So that's two different places, nucleus, cytosol. And proteins are made in the cytosol. Can anybody tell me why is it obvious that proteins are made in the cytosol? What do we see out here in, or cytoplasm? Let's say cytoplasm. Proteins are made in cytoplasm, not inside the nucleus. How would you kind of get a good sense of that? Why is that? Because there's an organelle in the cytoplasm that you know makes proteins. And what organelle is that? Ribosomes. Do you see ribosomes in the cytoplasm here? Indeed you do, right? And we don't see these ribosomes inside the nucleus. Okay, so you got to know what these two steps are. This first step, I have it written down right here. This first step is what we call transcription, right? What was that first step once again? DNA to RNA, transcription. And we says occurs in the nucleus, never in the cytoplasm. Yeah, that's really nice. All right, so why do we call it transcription? You're actually really familiar with that term. Maybe you haven't really thought about it in terms of this class. All right, but have you ever needed a transcript? Did you ever need to have transcription take place in anything in your life? And probably you have. Right, if you're applying for a job or to another college or something, they're going to ask for a transcript. And you're going to call up Admission and Records and say, hey, send a transcript to these people over here. And what is that transcript? It's a exact copy of what your grades are, what semester you took them, right, all that kind of stuff. So a transcript is a photocopy of the information that's held in Administration and Records. So what's the difference in that information between what Administration and Records has and what you send to another school? What's the difference in that information? The transcript. There's nothing. It's like a photocopy, right? So going from DNA to RNA is like a photocopy, and that's why we call it transcription. The building block of DNA is what we call a nucleic acid. The building block of RNA is a nucleic acid. So the language is the same, right? So RNA, there's just a small change in the structure of these nucleic acids that makes DNA different from RNA. Okay, so transcription. is like making a photocopy of DNA. That photocopy then can leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm right here, can be used to make a protein. But if that RNA is damaged, right, if some it bumps into an enzyme or something, is damaged, is this cell going to die? Right, if RNA is damaged but not DNA. And the answer is, well, if the RNA gets damaged, that's not such a big deal because where is that information held? It's inside the nucleus. The nucleus can make more RNA, right? And so the DNA is really important. That's like the reserve section of the library. And you can photocopy things that are in the reserve section of the library, take it home, and if you lose them, it's no big deal because you can go back to the library and make another photocopy of it, okay? All right, so that is transcription. The second step, right, is conversion of RNA into information in a protein. We call that translation. What was the building block of a protein once again? Building block of protein is amino acid. The building block of RNA is a nucleic acid. Nucleic acid. DNA and RNA are made up of nucleic acids. The building block of protein is amino acid. So what can you tell me about the language of RNA compared to protein? Are they the same? Nucleic acid, amino acid, they're different. They're way different kinds of molecules. So the language is different. But the information should be the same. The information in RNA should be exactly the same in this protein, just a different language. What do you call it when you take some information and convert it from English into Spanish, or English into Farsi, or Mandarin into English? What's that called? That's called translation, right? A translator is just somebody that knows both languages and can talk in both. It can convert one into the other. But when you translate something, does a translator ever change the information? Do they change the information? If they're good, they don't, right? The information is exactly the same, but it sounds and looks completely different, but the same information. Same thing for translation. Information in RNA is the same as the protein. It's just been converted from one form to another. That's what we call translation. These proteins then can do stuff inside of our cells. And where does translation take place? Where does translation take place? Okay, in the cytoplasm, because in the cytoplasm you have ribosomes, right? That's the deal right there. So the specific process that takes place on a ribosome is what we call translation, which is the second step of protein synthesis. So I think it'd be really handy for you to know about those two steps, where they take place. Okay. One thing that I didn't mention, right, when RNA is made, there are a couple different kinds of RNA. Remember I said a ribosome is made up of RNA? That's made in this transcription process. So ribosomal RNA, sometimes we just call rRNA, little r, capital N, capital A. All right, helps make a ribosome. We said that's the place where proteins are made. So think of ribosomal RNA, right, makes that workbench. Think of a ribosome as a workbench where proteins are put together from building blocks that we call amino acids. All right, well, if the ribosome or workbench is going to make a protein, it needs the building blocks or amino acids, and it's the job of transfer RNA or tRNA to look around in the cytoplasm all over the place, grab an amino acid, and bring it to a ribosome so it can be used to make a protein. That's what transfer RNA is used for, right? So ribosomal to make a ribosome, transfer to bring amino acids to that ribosome. You could think of transfer RNA as like taxi RNA if you wanted to. Little T, taxi RNA, right? Amino acids are hopping a ride to get to a ribosome. And then the information that the ribosome needs to make a protein is carried by what we call the messenger RNA. This is a really, really long strand of nucleic acids, messenger RNA. So there are three kinds that are necessary for translation. And all these three have to move into the cytoplasm. All right, so our last thing right here, cell division. We looked at this in lab pretty much, right? Remember, cell division we're going to call mitosis. And we're going to call that mitosis because so here we have a parent cell. It's going to divide and become two daughter cells. What is the difference between these two daughter cells right here? No difference whatsoever. They are exactly the same. Okay. And what's the difference between a daughter cell and a parent cell? Exactly the same. So mitosis produces the same cells over and over and over again, right? So for the first round of mitosis, one parent cell becomes two daughter. If there's going to be another round of mitosis, then each of these daughter cells make two. So you got 2, 4, and then 8, and then 16, right? Then 32. That would be exponential growth. That's a way of reproducing these cells. But it's a special kind of reproduction. It's called asexual reproduction. And you know this to be asexual reproduction because what's the difference between the offspring? No difference. What's the difference between the offspring and the parent? No difference, right? So asexual reproduction just produces the same thing over and over and over again. All right, so how are you reproduced? Asexually or sexually? If you look around the room, do you see another you anywhere? No, you don't, right? So you weren't produced by asexual reproduction. You were produced by sexual reproduction, which produces new and unique individuals, not the same thing. Everybody's different. We call that new and unique, right? So that's the big difference. Mitosis doesn't produce new and unique individuals. It produces the same thing over and over again. And remember, there's a number of steps to mitosis. You should write that out, IPMAT. Right, interphase is the phase of the cell cycle where the cell is not dividing but is doing its usual job. If it's an endocrine cell, it is making a hormone and secreting it. And then when it's ready to go through mitosis, then we got prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase, and you try to find some of these cells underneath the microscope last time. The easiest phase to see underneath the microscope, right, if it's mitosis, is metaphase, when all those chromosomes line up perfectly right in the center of the cell. And those chromosomes look like what? Tiny little worms. What kind of chromatin did you see when you saw those little worms inside the cell or those little chromosomes? What kind of chromatin is that? What are your choices? You got two choices. It's either extended or condensed. When you see a chromosome, you know what form that DNA is in. It's in a condensed form, right? That's a safe form, can't be damaged. That's really handy. All right, cytokinesis, all right, is something that happens within telophase, which is the last phase. So what's the difference between what's the difference between mitosis and cytokinesis? Anybody think of what the difference might be? There's a little bit of a difference. I like that. Mitosis is the separation of all of this DNA into two daughter cells. That's what mitosis is. Then that the DNA is going to be exactly the same in the parent cell compared to the two daughter cells. Cytokinesis, remember, is when the chromosomes are already separated and then the cell pinches apart into two cells. And that's when the cytoplasm gets separated from one cell to the other, right? So mitosis is the separation of genetic material. Cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two daughter cells, right? And cytokinesis for this class takes place within that very last phase of mitosis that we call telophase. So here is a pretty good question. What is cytokinesis? Right? It is separation. Separation of what? Cytoplasm. Exactly right. Okay. All right. So that's this chapter. Hopefully you did some pre-lecture reading assignments on this. So when I mentioned a term, maybe it was a brand new term for you. But if you did a little pre-lecture reading assignment, that made lecture a whole lot more fun because you knew what I was talking about or had a little sense of what I was talking about. Right? So students have told me, keep giving them pre-lecture reading assignments because it helps them in lecture, right? So I'm just passing that information on to you. And it's so important that I think I would like to see some of those pre-lecture reading assignments that you've completed, right? Just to make sure that you understand how important I think it is. I'm not going to grade them, but I just want to see if people have their time management going, working for them so you can pass the class. And I probably also would like to see your weekly study plan. So pass those things, make another copy, and give one, just put them on the desk in lab, and I can look them over. All right, I don't want to take them from you, but just give me a copy of it. And so I'd be really happy to look that stuff over to help you pass the class. Now, if you think that's not going to help you, you can opt out, right, because it's not part of your grade. But it's really best for you if you just go ahead, try to find some time and do it. The pre-lecture reading assignment is good before the lecture, but if you don't do it before lecture and you do it before a test, it's not too helpful because the information is kind of incomplete. It's very low-level information. It's information to help you understand the lecture, but the lecture is what brings you up to the level of information that you really need to know. So if you're only familiar with the pre-lecture reading assignment and not anything that we covered in lecture or the rest of the study guides for the lecture exam, it's going to be bad for you on a test. Right, so pre-lecture reading assignment, only a good introduction to what's going on. It's a fantastic introduction. Okay. One last question. In order to make a protein, how many steps are there? There are two. That's right. What's the first step? Transcription. And what's the second step? Translation, right? And remember, transcription takes place in the nucleus, translation in the cytoplasm, right? On a ribosome, because that's the workbench for making a protein. Okay, who's got some questions? Anybody got any questions on chapter 2? We're doing pretty good. All right, you got to go home and study. If you have a question when you're studying, probably write it down so you don't forget what it is. And ask me in class, or in lab, or in between those two. Oh, I got some really good news. I was talking about studying. Remember Jessica? Do you remember Jessica, who Jessica was? She was this woman that came into lab, introduced herself, and said she was a tutor for anatomy and other biology classes as well. Okay, that's the first time I met her, but I told some people that she stopped by, and everybody said, oh yeah, she was an SI leader at one time, for anatomy for actually a lot of years, so she's really good with anatomy. She knows anatomy backwards and forwards for this particular class. And she's agreed, okay, this week to be in that anatomy study room, which is really close to the anatomy lab and has all those extra models. So she's going to be in there to help people, to tutor people on concepts, or maybe help them look at a microscope or microscope slides or anything like that this week. There's only two more days this week, today and tomorrow, okay, from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. I should have sent everybody an email about that. So until 6 p.m. tonight, she will be in that room if you have questions. And you know what? Even if you don't have questions, you should probably go in there, introduce yourself to her, and say, hey, you know, so I don't really need your help right now, but maybe sometime later on in the semester I might need your help. I'm really glad to meet you. Glad you're over here in the study room. And if a lot of students need her help, she might come back during the semester and be in that room. Okay, and I'll try to get her back, especially before a practicum. Maybe not every day that we're in class, but before a practicum to help you guys really get ready for a practicum. And I think I'm going to invite her into lab also at certain times to just walk around lab and help answer questions, because I can't be everywhere at the same time. And then you can get to know her and see if she's really helpful for you to become familiar with the information. Okay. And remember, we said, how much did that cost? Actually, how much does it cost you? Nothing, right? It's free. But you know what? It's not really free. Somebody has to pay. And somebody wrote a grant or got money from someplace. So if you can take advantage of that, that'd be really, really good, especially if that helps you get through the class, right? Makes the class easier. Okay. So it'd really be good if we tell her we really appreciate what she's doing, and she can carry that back to her boss, and maybe they won't kill the program, because money is hard to find, right? Okay. So don't forget Jessica this week. 11 to 6 p.m., and then next week she'll be back in the LRC, which is the Learning Resource Center. So it's a little bit more effort to find her because you got to walk over there, right? But this week she'll be right there, which is really handy. Okay. All right, so next chapter. What the heck is the next chapter? Unless somebody has a question about that tutor. Anybody have a question about our tutor? No? Is anybody going to stop in, introduce yourself to her and say, hey, hi, glad you're here? Yeah, do it. Just do it. Okay? So that the ice is broken. If you have a question, then you're going to feel really comfortable asking her because she's really good and would really like to help you. Okay. All right, so let's put those slides away. Let's go to the next one. Okay, next one, histology. Here's histology. Okay. Well, cytology is the study of cells. And when we put a group of cells together and they all have the same shape, which means they have the same function, okay, what structure is formed when we put a whole bunch of cells together? So the cells are a building block for something, and that something is what we call a tissue, right? And so the study of tissues is what we call histology. The study of a cell is called cytology, and you should probably know what are the building blocks of a cell. If we're going to take a cell and break it down into its building blocks, what do we call those building blocks? Yeah, organelles, right? And the building block of an organelle is a chemical, so a chemical is the smallest thing. So we have a bunch of chemicals, put them together, that can make an organelle. If we have a bunch of organelles, put them together, it can make a cell. And if we have a bunch of cells, put them together, it can make a tissue. And if we, as a matter of fact, if we have different tissues and put them together, what do we get? An organ. Take a whole bunch of different organs, put them together, we get an organ system. And if we put organ systems together, what do we get? We get you. Right? So try to figure out that hierarchical organization of things, starting with the really small, building up until we get to you. All right, so we're still sort of at the beginning of that organizational chart. We're going to look at tissues, which are groups of cells. All right, so here we have the text slide that I'm going to use. Right, so a tissue is a group of cells with a similar structure, okay, which means what? It has a similar function. And even all the junk in between the cells is the same. And that's all that junk in between the cells is what we call what? The extracellular material. Extracellular material is the same in a tissue. The cells are the same and the function is the same. You just got thousands or millions of cells all together doing the same kind of thing. That's a tissue. All right. And it might seem pretty complicated, kind of daunting to think of that because humans are pretty complicated. But you know what? Your body is made up of only four different kinds of tissues. So fortunately, it's pretty simple to get a good understanding of what's going on. All right, so here are the four tissues. Epithelium. An epithelium is something that covers a surface or maybe lines a cavity. Covers a surface, lines a cavity. So your skin is what kind of tissue? It's an epithelium. Yeah, because it's covering a surface, right? Okay. Also, glands are made up of epithelium. Your sweat glands are made up of epithelium. They're not, that those cells aren't actually covering a cavity or lining a surface, but they're actually secreting something. Most are derived from epithelium. Okay, connective tissue does not cover a surface. It does pretty much what it says it does. It connects things together. All right, so there is a tissue that can connect a bone to a muscle. What kind of tissue would be something that can connect a bone to a muscle? It's connective tissue, right? And we're going to learn and see what kind of connective tissue it is, right? And, oh, and then the other one, I just mentioned it, muscle. What is muscle specialized to do? Everybody knows. Yeah, movement. And we can break it down into maybe a little bit more fundamental process, okay? And the fundamental process is what I would say contraction, okay? When a muscle contracts, that produces motion. So you are exactly right, okay? I'm just thinking a little bit more simply. Contraction, that's the job of a muscle. It can shorten, right? All right, and nervous tissue, the last one right here, it's responsible for taking information and transmitting it very rapidly from one place in your body to another far away place fast, right? We're using nerve impulses or electrical activity. That's what nervous system is for. There is something that we call a membrane. We talked about membranes. Here, most membranes are made of epithelium and connective tissue put together. And that's what's going to make a membrane, except for things that are just that phospholipid bilayer. Right? But there are other kinds of membranes in your body. All right, so let's start looking at epithelium. That's a good place to start looking. Okay, so we said characteristics of epithelium covers surfaces of the body, like your skin. And it also can line a cavity. The inside of your digestive tract is epithelium. The inside of a blood vessel is, the blood vessel has a cavity. It has epithelium on the inside. Epithelium can form glands. Epithelium is a kind of tissue where there's very little extracellular material. So if you have a cell, where is the neighboring cell if there's very little extracellular material? So my hand is one cell, where's going to be the next cell? Boom, right, touching it, right? No extracellular material. Since it's a sheet, right, because it's covering something, it has a free surface where there isn't your body, but there's some fluid, maybe it's blood or maybe it's air if it's your skin, right? We're going to call that the apical surface. And it has a basement membrane that these cells are attached to. And now here's something pretty funny. Actually, it's strange, maybe not funny. Never contains blood vessels. So here's a part of your body that doesn't contain blood vessels. And you sort of might be aware of that. Okay. Have you ever gotten a paper cut? Anybody ever get a paper cut? Terrible thing. Hurts. How does it hurt? Hurts like hell, right? So something, yeah, you probably don't even want to think about it. You might get goose pimples right now. Yeah, hurts like hell, stings, all right? And you're going to say, oh, man, it's going to bleed a lot because it hurt really, really bad. I better put some pressure on that cut because pressure will stop that bleeding, right? And then when you take your thumb away to look at it, it didn't even bleed, okay? And that's because what was damaged was epithelium. So there are some nerves that can go up into the epithelium. The nerves were cut, but since there's no blood vessels in epithelium, can it bleed? Can't bleed unless there's blood vessels there, right? So that's just a personal experience that probably you have noticed. Okay, when are we supposed to stop in here? 9:30? Okay, we got a couple minutes. All right. So here is a pretty good slide. And what do I see? I see some cells right here. Here's a nice nucleus, right? I see a bunch of cytoplasm. Oh, don't forget the sign-in sheet that's going around someplace, right? Anybody got the sign-in sheet? Did I forget? You got it, good. You can keep it until later. I just wanted to make sure I didn't forget to pass it around. Okay. Don't forget, that's your receipt for being in class. So here I see a bunch of cells. Here's that nice nucleus, and you can see them all lining up. And what about the space between these cells? Almost non-existent, right? So that's one way you can see an epithelium right away. And then underneath the epithelium, here is that membrane. We call that the basement membrane. On the other side of the cell, this is where, for instance, if this is skin, this is where air would be. If it's a blood vessel, this is where blood would be. And if it's part of your digestive tract, then this is where the digesting material would be, and then this would be inside your body. All right, so the surface that's connecting to the basement membrane is what we call the basal surface of these cells. The opposite end of the cell is what we call the apical region. Right, and so this is going to be some free space that's containing something, and it could be air. Right, so apical surface is here. Here's the basal surface. If we look at the basal surface and compare it to the apical surface, do they look the same? Do they look the same to you? No, right? Because here I see some cilia. Here I see some microvilli on the apical surface. Basement membrane is what? Flat and smooth. So if the surfaces look different by their shape, what can you tell me about their function? The function is different. They're even within one cell, different parts of the membrane can have different functions. And it's the job of the nucleus to control all that. It's pretty amazing. Okay. So here I see a nice nerve going up into the epithelium, but what about this blood vessel right here? Never goes up into the epithelium. Okay. Remember, epithelium doesn't ever have a blood vessel. Well, we want to be able to characterize epithelium. And this is how we characterize or classify epithelium. The first way is by the shape of the cell, And the second is by number of layers, from the apical surface to the basal surface over here. We would count the number of layers. So when I look at this cell right here, does it look spherical or like a pancake? It looks kind of like a cube, right? So this is what we call a cuboidal type cell. And how many layers of cells do you see from the basement membrane to the apical surface? How many cells? Just one, right? So that's a nice, what we call simple epithelium if it just has one layer. Let's look at a really nice slide that shows all of these different things. Let's look at the shape of cells. What are some possible shapes? Well, here's one that can look like a pancake or a fried egg. That's going to be a flat cell. A flat cell is what we call squamous. Squamous is just a term in anatomy that's used to describe something that's flat. The flat part of your head, right here, the flat part, it doesn't bulge out like that, like a basketball. Here's a flat part of your head. Guess what kind of region that flat part, what is that flat part called? It's called the squamous region of your head. Okay, so squamous just means flat. Or if the cell is tall and wide, okay, and deep, if all these dimensions are about the same, we call that a cuboidal cell. If one of those dimensions is very large compared to the other, like here, right, the height is very large, the width and the depth is kind of short, right, then we're going to call that a columnar cell. So an epithelium can either be a squamous, cuboidal, or columnar cell, and then we have to look at the number of layers. If there's just one layer, it's simple. If there are many layers, can you see there are many layers right here? Here's the basement membrane, here's the apical surface. How many layers do you see? One, two, three, four, five. I see five layers. Could that be a simple epithelium? Nope, by definition cannot be. This is what we call stratified. Right? So if it has two layers, it's stratified. If it has three, it's stratified. If it has four or five or six or 100, it's still a stratified epithelium. And in order to talk about it precisely, you have to tell me exactly what the shape of those cells are. And here are your choices, squamous, cuboidal, or columnar. One last point on this particular slide. You might notice that the cells in this row here near the basal surface have a different shape than the apical surface. These kind of look cuboidal down over here. And what do these on the apical surface look like by shape? Yeah, squamous. So how are we going to classify this particular epithelium? We always characterize it by the shape of the cells on this apical surface, not the basal surface. So this is a stratified epithelium for sure, but what kind by shape? Squamous, because that's the kind of cell I see on the apical surface, and it doesn't matter what these cells down here look like. That's just the convention we use to characterize or classify an epithelium. So how many ways do we use to classify an epithelium? How many? So give me a number. One, two, three, zero. Two ways. One way is by shape. The other way is by layers, number of layers, right? And so here I see number of layers. Here I see shape. Then we can completely characterize an epithelium. Okay. So this is where we're going to start in lab, actually, today. Use a microscope, look at these cells. And so here, let's just see, here's a cell right here. What kind of cell does this look like? A cube, a column, or a pancake? It looks like a cube to me. So this, and here's the basement membrane, here's the apical surface, so there's only one layer of cells. This would be a simple cuboidal epithelium. All right, so we're just going to train our eye to observe some of these structures in lab. And next time I'll continue. Show you some more slides on epithelium. Oh, what about this one? Here's that basement membrane. Here's the apical surface. Is this simple or stratified? Simple. And what's the shape of the cell here? Columnar. So here's a simple columnar epithelium. All right, so it's not too bad. Once you develop an eye to see some of these things, you're going to be really happy to see these questions on a test or a practicum. Okay, don't forget, sign the sign-in sheet. Don't forget Scantron that you're going to need next week, a pencil, eraser, photo ID. Get these things together this week or over the weekend. Don't wait until next week and do it at the last moment because you might freak out or something, right, because you're doing too much. Get it all set up ahead of time. Okay, pretty soon I'll get these lectures online. I just got to make the web page to put them on there. Okay, if you have a question, come on down and ask me before lab.